Welcome to Pomegranate Health. I'm Mick Cavazzini for the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. In the words of the Beatles, I get by with a little help from my friends. My guest host today is one of the most recently appointed podcast reviewers, Dr. Rahul Barmanroy. Welcome, Rahul.
Thanks so much.
The most attentive listeners might remember you from one of the IMJ On Air episodes back in January 2023, presenting an observational study you conducted at Royal Melbourne Hospital, where, am I right, you're a consultant endocrinologist there?
That's right.
Tell us what else we should know about your work.
Yeah, so my clinical roles at present are working in endocrinology and general medicine at Royal Melbourne, working in endocrinology at Western Health, as well as just completing a PhD now through Melbourne University, looking at the effect of proactive glycemic control in patients admitted to hospital. Mm-hmm. Also have the opportunity to advise some non-invasive glucose monitoring technology startup by the name of OPAS, and have really big interest in prevention of complications in diabetes, vascular complications in particular.
Thanks so much for volunteering a paper for this new sort of journal club format. So the article we're looking at today was published December 7 in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's titled Baricitinib and the Beta Cell Function in Patients with New Onset Type 1 Diabetes. And it was authored by a cast of clinicians and lab researchers from Melbourne's top institutions. Before we introduce a couple of those authors to talk about the paper, give me your elevator pitch on why this was important.
Yeah, so look, while we've been able to change the course of some autoimmune diseases, of which type 1 diabetes is very much one, it's still predominantly treated with hormone replacement therapy following the occurrence of irreversible end-organ damage. But as most of our listeners will be familiar, insulin replacement has a really high treatment burden associated with it, and it's not just insulin, it's glucose checking and all the rest of it, and that Even then, it doesn't abolish the vascular complications, the risk of premature death associated with poor glycemic control, and in fact, the disease process itself. So in the last few years, research in animal models has given us some hope. The residual pancreatic beta cell function, which is present at the time of diagnosis of clinical diabetes, can be preserved, and that in so doing, we can reduce the dependence on insulin therapy. Maybe not lifelong, but at least for a time. So a quick picture of the immunology behind type 1 diabetes. The beta cells, those cells in the pancreas that produce insulin, they present autoantigens on surface receptors called MHC class 1. As an aside, hopefully all Australians know about Peter Doherty, the Australian Nobel laureate who actually discovered these, so it's very much a close-to-home topic. And these are recognised by the CD8-positive T cells as targets for apoptosis, for cellular destruction. But in preclinical studies, the surface expression of these MHC class 1 molecules can be reduced by blocking these intracellular effectors called Janus kinases, specifically JAK1 and JAK2. So if you can stop the formation of these immune synapses between the beta cells and those CD8-positive T cells, then you should be able to prevent the death of the beta cells. And then if you can preserve the function of beta cells, you should see improvements in glycemic control because you have further endogenous production of insulin, or at least more than you would have otherwise had. And so that's what was demonstrated in the trial that we're going to talk about today.
Perfect, thanks. Okay, well, let's get our guest authors on the line. Baricitinib was already approved by the Australian Registry of Therapeutic Goods in 2018 under the brand name Olumiant. It's listed as a second-line therapy for adult patients with moderate to severe active rheumatoid arthritis and severe alopecia areata. It's also indicated for the treatment of moderate to severe atopic dermatitis in adults who are candidates for systemic therapy. The trial we're talking about today in children and adults newly diagnosed with type 1 diabetes was nicknamed Bandit. The study had 40 researchers behind it, and I won't name them all here. The first two authors of this paper are Michaela Weibel, PhD of St. Vincent's Institute of Medical Research, and Associate Professor John Wentworth of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. We've had him on the podcast before in his role as IMJ Section Editor for Endocrinology. There are other authors of this paper affiliated with Royal Melbourne Hospital, Royal Children's Hospital, Melbourne Uni, and the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. Speaking with us today are Professor Jenny Cooper.
I'm a paediatric endocrinologist at the Women and Children's Hospital in Adelaide.
And Dr. Michelle So.
I'm an adult endocrinologist. So I work at Royal Melbourne and the Northern Hospital, and then do a bit of clinical research at St. Vincent's Institute.
Michelle, Jenny, thanks so much for joining us. So first of all, in this trial that you conducted called Bandit, you tried baricitinib out for the first time in patients with new onset symptomatic type 1 diabetes. Many listeners may not be very familiar with the staging system of type 1 diabetes. Could you perhaps, first of all, briefly summarise this for those who aren't familiar?
So the first stages are the pre-symptomatic stages. And stage 1 is when you have multiple ARTI antibodies, but your blood glucose levels are normal. And stage 2 is when you have multiple ARTI antibodies and your blood glucose is what we call a bit dysglycemic. It goes up after food, but then comes down again, but you still importantly have no symptoms. And then stage 3 is when you have diagnostic type 1 diabetes with raised blood glucose levels, but symptoms are starting to appear at that time as well. And that's the stage where clinical type 1 diabetes remission has begun.
Yeah, thanks. And most studies like this have quite a long journey that's behind them. Could you describe to us how this study was conceived?
Yeah. So there's been decades of work done on JAK inhibition in preclinical models, and it has been shown that it can preserve beta cells in vitro, as well as in the NOD mouse model, so the mouse model that most reflects human type 1 diabetes.
That's the non-obese diabetes mouse model, is it not?
Yes, yeah, that's the one. And that showed not only that it could preserve insulin production in the mouse, but even potentially a reverse type 1 diabetes. Now, of course, in human type 1 diabetes, you want to ultimately prevent for insulin, but we would usually in immunotherapy trials in type 1 diabetes start at recent onset. They're easier to detect, and when you get it very early in the diagnosis, you've got enough beta cell function to be able to see the amount of C-peptide that they have and prevent the decline. So that was the rationale behind that, and baricitinib was already available for use in other disease states, and so we didn't need to go to long-standing type 1 diabetes as a safety precaution, which is often what is done for drugs that are completely experimental.
It's just a lovely Australian story, because Professor Tom Kay and Professor Helen Thomas have been working together at St Vincent's for 30 years. There are many people that should be mentioned, but I guess they were the ones that underpinned the study for so many years. And the last 10 to 12 years of which was work underpinning this very successful trial. So a completely Australian discovery right from the bench right through to the bedside.
And I'll skim over some of the study design so we can cut to the chase. The trial was a phase 2 double-blind placebo-controlled RCT conducted across multiple Victorian centres over 2 years, starting November 2020. You recruited patients between 10 and 30 years of age diagnosed with type 1 diabetes no more than 100 days before starting the trial. And you naturally excluded patients with coexisting conditions that could confound your interpretation, like cytopenias, known cancer, or anyone receiving other immunomodulatory treatment. So this left you with 60 patients assigned to receive baricitinib and 31 to receive placebo. All received standard care for diabetes with a targeted glycated hemoglobin level of less than 7% in adults and less than 7.5% in children. Have I missed anything critical?
I think that sounds like a good summary.
Okay. Back to you, Rahul.
Yeah, so the primary outcome of this trial was the mean C-peptide level during a two-hour mixed meal tolerance test after 48 weeks of daily treatment with baricitinib. And in the week 48 assessment, you found a significantly higher meal-stimulated C-peptide in the baricitinib group than in the placebo group, median of 0.65 nanomoles per litre per minute versus 0.43 nanomoles per litre per minute, so quite a difference. So what does this tell us about insulin secretion in these patients?
So just taking a step back, the mixed meal tolerance test is the current gold standard for measuring endogenous insulin secretion in type 1 diabetes. So C-peptide is used as a surrogate of insulin, and it's measured every 30 minutes for 2 hours after a standardized drink. So it's got like carbs, lipids, and proteins, and then we derive the area under the curve. So typically with the onset of type 1 diabetes over the first year, you would expect a gradual decline of endogenous insulin secretion. So this was observed as expected in the group of individuals receiving placebo. But in contrast, we found in the individuals who took baricitinib for 48 weeks, the mean C-peptide levels were relatively preserved. C-peptide only dropped by 4% from baseline as opposed to 30% in the placebo group. So that indicates that baricitinib was able to protect the individual's beta cells from immune distraction and maintain their endogenous insulin production.
Mm-hmm. And for comparison, this effect of baricitinib on C-peptide levels was similar in size to that of interventions such as teplizumab?
Yeah.
Low-dose antithymocyte globulin and golimumab. But these all require intravenous infusion or subcutaneous injection. So is adherence a big problem in those other therapies?
Well, I guess as a pediatrician, I mean, no, in as much as if you give an infusion, adherence really isn't the issue. The issue is the burden for the individual. And, for example, teplizumab, which is a good comparison, I think, because the increments were not dissimilar in C-peptide with baricitinib. It requires 12 to 14 infusions over that many days. And so you can imagine for a younger child in particular, that requires long lines and anaesthetic for long lines. So the intensity of the care is a much greater burden, and for most families would be a substantial put off at this stage, even if it's safe in the overall scheme of things. So it's an enormous advantage, certainly from younger children and families, from oral treatment.
So considering the outcome of this study, the patients treated with baricitinib needed less insulin at 48 weeks than those receiving placebo, but they still needed insulin treatment. It's not like we abrogated the need for insulin entirely. So how would you describe the benefit of this reduction in exogenous insulin requirements, this partial preservation at least of beta cell function?
These were people with so-called stage 3 type 1 diabetes, so we weren't anticipating that they would be able to come off insulin because much of the insulin-producing cells are already being destroyed. So it's really late in the progress. But by reducing exogenous insulin requirements, we're basically saying we've increased endogenous insulin production. And it's been shown in longer-term studies that the benefit of even preserving small amounts of your own insulin at really substantially even lower levels than what was shown in this study has quite significant meaningful reductions in vascular complications of type 1 diabetes and in severe hypoglycemia. And there are other benefits which I think we're only more recently able to pick up, such as less variation in blood glucose levels with more of your own insulin, which also are very benefit for how the patient feels. So even preserving some and still requiring exogenous insulin is still a benefit to the patients.
So to paraphrase, the pancreas is still the best determinant of insulin requirements than a human brain or than even a pump brain.
And I guess another thing we didn't completely look at in this study, but you could argue future studies, that if you could just reduce a patient's insulin schedule to, e.g., one injection a day, rather than four or continuous insulin pump delivery, that would also be an enormous reduced burden of care. So the complete reduction of any need for insulin would be the ideal, but even these lesser changes still greatly help the patient.
Well, the maximum difference between the groups in terms of C-peptide levels and in insulin doses was already seen by 12 weeks, and the gap didn't really increase over 24 or 48 weeks. So does this tell you something about the way the drug is impacting beta cell function or the way the disease is progressing in the placebo group?
Well, I think if there was to be an effect, it would be seen quite soon and would have some ceiling, as it were, because we've got a limited number of insulin-producing cells remaining. We can't precisely define that. And indeed, that is the way other effective immunomodulatory agents have worked relatively quickly, and then with some ceiling on that benefit. So I think that was anticipated just looking at other studies and the stage of disease which we're at in these sorts of studies.
And secondary outcomes included the glycated hemoglobin level, the total daily insulin dose, and glycemic control as assessed with the use of a continuous glucose monitoring device. So at week 48 of the study, continuous glucose monitoring showed there was less variation in interstitial glucose level in the treatment group, and measures of time within range and time above range also favoured the baricitinib treatment. Can you explain for a generalist how each of these different measures might fill in a different part of the picture you're looking at?
Yeah, sure. So as Jenny mentioned, it's about preservation of endogenous insulin secretion. And if you imagine you're preserving the endogenous insulin secretion, you would expect a clinically significant impact on the amount of exogenous insulin required to maintain glycemic control. And so sure enough, we found that that mean daily insulin dose was significantly lower at 48 weeks and still managed to maintain a similar level of glucose control. So that baricitinib having a mean HbA1c of 7% at 48 weeks was comparable to the 7.5% in placebo. They weren't statistically different. The other key secondary outcome was that continuous glucose monitoring. So every participant wore continuous glucose monitor, which measures the interstitial glucose levels every few minutes, and that was worn for 2 weeks at very specific time points, so baseline, week 12, week 24, week 48. And it can give a more granular picture of glucose control compared to a three-month average, which is what HbA1c does. So the most significant improvement was the glucose variability. So we measured that with the coefficient of variation, and that was significantly lower in the baricitinib group. So that wasn't, I guess, surprising in a way, because where you've got endogenous insulin secretion preserved, your own native way of being able to manage meals is better. And that finding was consistent with continuous glucose monitoring studies in preclinical diabetes, where they found that those people more likely to progress to clinical diabetes had a rise in this glucose variability. And time in range would be similarly self-explanatory, like you have people managing to stay within the target range more often where their own pancreas is producing insulin.
So yeah, tell me if I'm going off on a branch here. It looked like there was a glitch in one of those trends. The curves for time within range and time above range were significantly different between the cohorts at week 12 and 24, but they dipped closer together at week 48, such that the error bars actually overlapped. And this seemed to be because the placebo group was actually improving a little rather than the baricitinib group getting any worse. What do you think could be going on there?
Yes, I think we've got to realise that while it was really nice to see these changes in time and range, but trials looking at commercially available automated delivery pumps that are now available that can improve time and range quite independent of improving C-peptides. So I think the sort of answer really is that time and range is affected by many things. One of them is C-peptide, but there's also effects of exactly how the patient's able to negotiate the care and the fat of the type 1 diabetes, exactly what their method of insulin delivery is, exactly how well-tuned they are in relation to their system of insulin delivery, etc. There are so many variables affecting time and range that it's not surprising that there wasn't a sort of perfect relationship at all.
Now, with any trial product, we're, of course, always very interested in the side effect profile. I suppose baricitinib itself is not a trial product. It is approved, just not in this in this context. It's reassuring that the frequency or severity of events, adverse events, was no different between the groups. No events were attributed to either baricitinib or placebo. But this, is, of course, is an immunomodulatory treatment, so clinicians might rightly be worried about adverse effects related to immunosuppression. How concerned should general clinicians be about immunosuppression-related adverse effects with the use of baricitinib specifically in patients with preclinical or clinical type 1 diabetes?
I think the term being used a lot now is we're sort of tweaking the immune system. This is not what we would generally understand as, you know, immune suppression. It's immune modulation. And there's obviously an enormous difference. I mean, there is a history also, a good history, of JAK inhibitors safety in this age group. I'm really under the sort of 65 age group. It's very good safety data. And of course, a short trial like this can't address this question, but longer term trials in children down to 2 years had not really shown severe adverse effects due to immunomodulation. Similarly, agents such as teplizumab and abrocept thus far seem to be very well tolerated.
And just to fill in for our listeners, the wider spread use we're talking about, so baricitinib is already widely available to treat rheumatoid arthritis, alopecia areata, and severe coronavirus disease, and other JAK inhibitors you've mentioned used to treat juvenile arthritis and inflammatory bowel disease. So is that the pool of long-term data you're talking about?
I guess it's also used to treat severe atopic dermatitis, and it's also used to treat severe ulcerative colitis and a sort of rare form that affects quite young children as well.
And of course, the Bandit study isn't occurring in isolation. In 2019, the results of teplizumab delaying the onset of clinical type 1 diabetes was presented at the American Diabetes Association conference. I was lucky enough to be there in the audience and received a standing ovation. It created quite a stir in the diabetes community and lay media alike. I think the company that made teplizumab, their share price increased by 200% overnight or something ridiculous. The Bandit trial is different, targeting a different population for one thing. How else does Bandit complement, build upon, or differ from previous evidence on teplizumab or related agents?
I guess in a way, every immune therapy trial performed in type 1 diabetes builds on the other. So if you picture in your mind a schematic of a beta cell and the different cells of the immune system that are involved in the pathophysiology of type 1 diabetes, so you have that CD8 T effector cell instigating the attack, you have antigen-presenting cells stimulating the T cells, and the B cells also activating the T cells, and then you've got the cytokines that make up the inflammatory milieu. Each immune modulating agent has added to our understanding of what part of that schematic is critical to the ultimate destruction of the beta cell and at what stage of the disease that we can actually modulate the disease trajectory. So teplizumab is an anti-CD3 antibody. So for the listeners, CD3 is a protein complex present on all T cells, and it's believed teplizumab was effective by impairing T cell function by inducing partial CD8 T cell exhaustion. So it's been shown to be effective now in stage 2 and stage 3 type 1 diabetes. On the other hand, baricitinib blocks the formation of immune synapses between beta cells and CD8 T cells, and that prevents the death of beta cells, or believed to. So both demonstrate the critical role of the T cell in type 1 diabetes pathophysiology, but work via quite different mechanisms. So teplizumab's cell surface, baricitinib is intracellular signaling. But similar to teplizumab, the next step for baricitinib would be to determine the efficacy in stage 2 type 1 diabetes, so to delay the need for exogenous insulin, and that will be critical to understanding the role of JAK1, 2, or JAK inhibition in general in the disease.
And I think you've alluded to this already, that many patients diagnosed with stage 3 type 1 diabetes have too much irreversible damage to their beta cell mass for cessation of insulin therapy to be a realistic goal. And you speculate that initiating baricitinib earlier might produce greater benefits, but how would you identify patients with pre-symptomatic type 1 diabetes in that sort of strategy?
Well, stage 2 in particular is not such an easy stage to pick up. And there's an enormous difference between a stage 1, which is progressing very slowly, or a stage 1 that's just about to progress through to stage 2 in terms of its likely response. So the only way to find these people is to screen. And there are screening programs in Australia, but I guess none as yet are being ready to completely take this quite enormous task on. There's a type 1 screen program looking at first-degree relatives and screening people who are at increased risk, because they're 15 times the risk of someone without a first-degree relative. And there's been a pilot also in this country of general population screening to see the health economics and also the benefits of potentially having a general population screening program. If we were, though, to move towards, for example, a stage 2 trial of baricitinib, it seems almost very unlikely that Australia alone could do such a trial, and it would almost certainly need to be a multinational study.
Okay, but the on paper, you know, on the back of an envelope, the costs of population screening aren't an immediate non-starter. It is no. worth investigating.
And I mean, globally, I mean, Italy has just passed a law whereby public health units are required to implement general population screening, but there are also good examples. First in Bavaria and also in Colorado and other parts of the USA where general population screening is occurring over discrete areas. So this is certainly happening internationally, primarily to prevent the serious complication of ketoacidosis when people are present really late with type 1 diabetes and require intensive care, but also to monitor people so they have a more gentle entry into requiring insulin and have good education prior to starting that.
Right, so yeah, of course you're offsetting those very big costs of downstream treatment. And
yep.
And I don't know if you want to go into this, you collected some mechanistic outcomes to explore a downstream stage in the signaling pathway involving transcription factors, STAT1 and STAT3. Did you find some support for the model?
Yes, we did. We were expecting baricitinib to inhibit JAK-STAT pathway signaling as measured by the phosphorylation of STAT1 and STAT3, as you mentioned, in our assays. And we did find this to be the case. And so it is a good measure of pharmacodynamics of baricitinib activity in our participants.
And following on from that, from your preclinical studies, you speculate that there's this signaling role for interferon gamma signaling at these immune synapses between the CD8 positive T cells and the beta cells. So how might this possibility inform the design of future trials?
So actually the model is that interferon gamma induces upregulation of HLA class 1 on the beta cells, which increases the ability of CD8 T cells to recognize beta cells. So this might not happen actually in the immune synapse. The interferon gamma might be made by other cell types like CD4 or CD4 T cells or macrophages, for example. So we can't actually measure this in our participants because we don't have access to their islets or beta cells, but we have shown it to be the case in mouse studies. So this might inform future trials with different, more selective JAK inhibitors. For example, one that just blocks JAK1, which blocking JAK1 should still inhibit interferon gamma signaling, so would be appropriate to test according to this model.
So in those NOD mice who've experienced remission of type 1 diabetes with this JAK inhibitor therapy, there's been this gradual relapse after cessation of treatment. So similarly in human patients with autoimmune alopecia or juvenile idiopathic arthritis, recurrence of disease has been observed on discontinuation of JAK inhibitor treatment. So you know, what are the implications of this for future research with regards to JAK inhibition and management of type 1 diabetes with such therapies?
I mean, the second year of the study, put the participants off any treatment has not yet been analysed, but we would anticipate that the benefit will wane relatively quickly when it's stopped, according to those studies, and indeed particularly according to the clinical data which you present in people with alopecia who get a response and then stop it quickly, that can return, which is obviously a very visible, clear loss of benefit.
And following on from some other things that you've mentioned, Michelle, you mentioned when you were describing the various cellular targets, you know, there's JAK inhibition, you know, teplizumab targeting CD3 on T cells, you know, you can target various elements, imagining a model like you described. Is there any possibility in the future that we'll see combinations of these elements, for example, baricitinib and teplizumab perhaps?
Yes, that's a great question. And definitely baricitinib, it would be a great drug to trial in combination therapy. There's already a trial currently open in Melbourne through TrialNet and I believe other states in Australia using rituximab and abatacept. And also there's one looking at intranasal insulin and abatacept. So there are combination therapies being trialed already and, yeah, it will only get better because of the number of immune modulating therapies are showing efficacy in type 1 diabetes.
And I'm glad you mentioned TrialNet because that really is my next question. Let's say you're an endocrinologist or even a GP and you find a patient with early stage diabetes. How can a practitioner perhaps refer patients to be involved in these studies? Obviously, the studies are moving at a very quick pace, and the studies that are available and so on is going to be changing very quickly. Is there any ability for doctors to refer patients, say, to your trial program?
Well, there's an ATIC, A-T-I-C, the Australian Trials Immunotherapy Collaborative, links sites around the country in each state which have been involved in these studies, but also has information very clearly about the current studies that are recruiting. So I think the first step really would be to go to that website.
And how long might you expect it to take to progress successfully through phase three and to changed indications at the TGA?
Oh.
Don't want to gamble on that question.
I guess a phase three study is in different hands. I think that is a big question, a very important one, and certainly discussions are occurring.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up from that, I'd like to convey to listeners that this was an investigator-initiated trial. The questions weren't being asked by Big Pharma, but what declarations of interest would you like to share?
I don't have any declarations of interest.
No, conflict of interest.
Apart from donations of the drug.
Yep, the drug was provided by Lilly, but they had no involvement in the analysis, the write-up, or any subsequent part.
So thanks so much for answering our questions thus far. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to convey to the listeners about this study, the wider program?
I think something that struck me was just the enthusiasm of families to come in. I mean, I'm a paediatrician. We did actually look after children at my centre. It was obviously the only centre in South Australia up until 30, but most of them were younger families. We're in the middle of COVID. You wouldn't have thought so keen to come to the hospital. Melbourne was locked down a lot of the time of the study. And yet, despite that, there really was an excellent recruitment rate that actually exceeded even the projected required recruitment rate. And I think that was just an interesting kind of statement on the enthusiasm, how the families feel about this work. Do you want to add to that, perhaps, Michelle?
Yeah, just to follow on from what you said, Jenny, it was during the pandemic and we didn't show any significant differences in COVID infections between the two groups. So it just shows again, baricitinib was extremely well tolerated and safe, and generally all the immune therapy trials that have shown efficacy haven't shown any severe adverse events. And so I think as generalists and even general endocrinologists can sometimes feel a little bit nervous about immune therapy in type 1 diabetes and or think that it's technology versus immune therapy. But I think immune therapy has an increasing place in the management of type 1 diabetes, and it's going to be part of the equation to improve the quality of lives of people with type 1 diabetes.
As I was editing this podcast, I was asked by a couple of reviewers about the economic calculus for such therapy. The answer turned out to be much messier than I expected. Well, the first part is easy enough. Baricitinib is subsidised by Australia's pharmaceutical benefits schedule to the tune of $1,270 for 28 pills, which adds up to $16,555 for a whole year's supply. Not cheap, but nor is the cost of type 1 diabetes itself. In a 2020 paper from the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation and accounting firm Accenture, analysts took a top-down approach to this problem. Medication, blood tests, consults, and hospital care added to about $0.7 billion a year in direct costs across Australia. And there was another $0.4 billion in unemployment benefits, disability support, and formal care. Dividing this by the 127,000 Australians living with type 1 diabetes gets you a figure of $8,600 per patient per year, of which about a quarter is shouldered by private payers. By contrast, in a 2009 analysis for Diabetes Australia called DiabCost, researchers came to an average of about $3,800 a year in direct costs for each person with type 1 diabetes. This study went bottom-up, relying on surveys with 2,200 randomly selected patients or their families, and they included in these costs expenses on transport to medical appointments and diabetic-appropriate food. Patients with multiple complications could have annual costs almost four times higher than the mean, and these included neuropathy, cardiovascular disease, blindness, and kidney disease. To get some clarity on this question, I spoke to Professor Colaguri of the University of Sydney, who led the DIAB cost study. He said that the difference of almost $5,000 between the two cost estimates could in part be explained by the rollout of insulin pumps and continuous glucose monitoring devices in the decade between the publication of those studies. These high-tech interventions can each cost a few thousand dollars a year per person, and the Australian government subsidises this cost for about 58,000 people under the age of 21 or with specific indications. But the two research papers differed much more when it came to the indirect costs of type 1 diabetes, the lost productivity and diminished well-being of patients or their carers. Where the DIAB cost group arrived at an average of $800 per patient based on their surveys, the accountants behind the JDRF modelling produced a figure of almost $15,000. They don't display a lot of working publicly, but say that this latter estimate was derived from the health economist's nominal value of a statistical life year, $213,000, then scaled by the years and quality of life lost to death and disability. The accountants also used national wage data and tax data to put a number on lost productivity, and also leaned on some of the findings from the prior DIAB cost study. For example, from respondents who were of working age, about a third were not in employment at the time of the survey, and a third of those said they weren't able to work at all because of their disease. Of the carers who responded to the survey, 19% reported that they weren't working in order to care for the person with diabetes, and most of those who were working had to give up almost a full day of work each month. On top of these economic impacts, both studies also considered less easily quantifiable ones like quality of life and the mental health impacts of chronic disease. From the information at hand, I can't say whether the indirect costs of type 1 diabetes were underreported in the surveys or weighted too highly in the JDRF's modelling. I suspect a bit of both. But whether the total yearly economic burden of type 1 diabetes is closer to $4,700 per patient or $22,000 seems important when deciding whether to fund a drug that costs $16,500 a year. Or is it? As Professor Stephen Colaguri said to me, as much as we'd like the numbers to give us a black and white answer, there are judgment calls right throughout the process, not least the subjective determination of what a statistical life is worth. Professor Thomas Kay, who led the Bandit trial, said that new treatments are often more expensive than old ones when they're introduced, but we back them because they have advantages for the target population. He added that we can expect baricitinib to get cheaper once other competitors and generics make it to market. Both professors noted that we already choose to fund antivirals for Hep C that cost over $100,000 per patient, or immunotherapies for cancer that sometimes only grant an extra year or two of life. At the end of the day, there's always a moral variable in these funding decisions too, and we naturally weight quality of life in children very high. Even if groundbreaking therapies like teplizumab and baricitinib only delay type 1 diabetes, rather than preventing it outright, they can help kids reach their full potential during the formative years. As mentioned earlier though, the catch is in identifying the right candidates for early intervention. Every year in Australia there are some 3,000 new diagnoses of type 1 diabetes, from an estimated pool of about 25,000 people with preclinical disease. Screening for islet autoantibodies has shown pretty good sensitivity in cohorts with genetic risk factors for type 1 diabetes, but not so much in undifferentiated populations. The mechanics and mathematics behind screening programs are a fascinating puzzle in their own right, and one we'll have to come back to in another episode. For now, I want to thank Michelle So and Professor Jenny Cooper for contributing their expertise to Pomegranate Health. Professors Stephen Colaguri and Thomas Kay were also very patient with all my questions. And many thanks to Rahul Barmanrai for volunteering to host this Journal Club episode. If you've come across some hot research conducted by RACP members, please share it with me and consider whether you'd like to act as a guest interviewer. You can write to the address podcast@racp.edu.au. I'd love to help share more member-generated content like this, particularly from specialty groups who can contribute regularly. Perhaps you have a colleague who's just given a great lecture. If you sketch out some questions to tease out that material, I can record the conversation and share it with the broad Pomegranate audience. Did you know that every episode gets downloaded over 6,000 times over the first 12 months from publication? And on those numbers, we're probably among the top 7% of podcasts on the internet. Interestingly, a fifth of listeners are located outside of Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand. And did you know that every month there are several webinars hosted by the college and specialty societies? Members should already receive an email titled RACP Events Digest, and some recordings can be found later under past event presentations from the RACP homepage, at the college YouTube channel, or the Medflix video library located at elearning.racp.edu.au. There really is something for everyone. This podcast was produced by the Waters of the Gadigal people. I pay respect for their custodianship of this country over tens of thousands of years. I'm Mick Cavazzini. Thanks for listening.